Hey, Nick, thanks for stopping by the studio, man.
Of course, man. Thanks for having me. Glad I was in town and I could do it.
So you're staying in Park City right now. You're hanging out in Park City?
Yeah, visiting my dad and sister in town and kind of planned this snowboarding trip. So we figured we'd come out, but there's no snow. So we're kind of making do with what we got.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. So I've never been, I went snowboarding once and I grew up skateboarding. So I picked it up pretty easy. Went skiing once and ate shit. It was a horrible experience. But I'm getting into this whole lifestyle that's like the snow world.
Yeah.
And everybody right now is bummed out because, I mean, the weekend right now, it's sunny. And I mean, we're looking at the mountain and there's no snow anywhere.
Yeah, well, I was driving up and the temperature said 46 on the truck. And I was like, how the hell is there going to be any snow? And then yesterday, first few runs, was just nothing but ice. So trying to navigate that.
So yeah, what happens when there's just ice, they do artificial snow, but they can only do so much of that.
Yeah, and they're only doing it on certain runs, and I believe they have like 140 runs open, but they're only blowing snow on two at a time. So,
oh my gosh.
And then that funnels everybody and all the tourists into that one run. So
yeah,
you're just kind of left up to your own demise.
Yeah, no, I have a buddy, Joe, who came out here with his family, and their whole little trip's ruined. I mean, they booked, obviously, everything in advance.
Yeah.
But the whole deal is ruined.
And that's a problem booking in advance and like living out of state is you just kind of, it's a roll of the dice on conditions and trying to figure out what that's going to look like.
But they're saying it's a horrible winter, but dude, I remember like 2 months ago, it was like a blizzard here. I mean, there's been blizzards periodically.
Just but not
all of a
sticking.
Sudden, it just got warm all of a sudden. It's weird how, I mean, it's like a warm snap. But I love the weather here, man. It's amazing.
Yeah, Utah is probably definitely one of the most beautiful states I've ever been through and driving around. I've been to Moab and Bryce Canyon and, you know, all the other epic parks that you have here. So I'm going to make it a point after I leave on Monday just to stay there and kind of camp out in the back of the truck and take a bunch of photos of Bryce Canyon and see what I can do.
So what are you up to lately, man? I mean, we've known each other for years going back and forth. You have a business yourself, you're doing photography, you're contracting, you're doing a whole bunch of stuff. Well, what's like, let's talk about for people who don't know who you are, give a little context or background and then kind of what you're doing now.
Yeah. So, 2005, I enlisted in the Army. I originally tried to come in as a combat photographer because my hopes and aspirations of being a golf professional at Arizona State got fizzled literally due to a cigarette. And so I enlisted, and that was in 2005, so they weren't given really much of an option, so they told me I could be infantry or cook, and I certainly wasn't going to flip burgers in Baghdad, so I said, all right, let's go infantry. And so got stationed over in Germany, got deployed pretty much right away to Ramadi in 2006, and that was a pretty gnarly 15-month tour there.
You guys were attached to SEALs as well.
Yeah, that time, yeah, right? We were attached to 3 and 5. And what was kind of funny is, you know, those guys' deployments are, you know, a lot shorter than ours. And so we had 3 when we first got there, and then they ripped out with 5. And then 3 came back, and it's the same guys. And they're like, what the fuck are you still doing here? We're like, well, this is the Army.
Yeah, welcome to the Army.
Yeah. But yeah, we ended up having really good relationships with those guys. You know, there's some big hitters on that tour, and unbeknownst to me at the time, you know, I was only 18, but, you know, Jocko was there. Chris Kyle was there. Yep. Marcus and Morgan Luttrell were both there.
Yep.
So we were really able to help out because we were a mech unit. So we had the Bradleys, and we were helping them do infills and exfills, you know, under contact and stuff. And they were just working with kind of like slick Humvees. So
that's really cool.
We were able to really help those guys out and kind of lay an ass whooping on that city and really quell the violence by the end of it. Because we left in 2008 and the city really changed. Really.
So
changed.
You did a 15-monther.
Yeah.
Oof.
Yeah, I did 15 there, got back to Germany, and then did another tour shortly after to like northern Iraq. And that was absolutely, I mean, we didn't do anything. It was literally just standstill.
Like Erbil area?
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, there wasn't even a single round fire the entire time, which, you know, for better or worse, but it just leads to boredom, but at least you're coming back with all your dudes. Then I ended up PCS in Fort Carson. That's when I went recon, got selected there, and then they pushed me over the sniper section. And then the difference between Army Europe and Army Stateside is very polarizing. It's black and white. The budget in the States was just bountiful. So as soon as I got to Carson, it was just school after school after school. Went to sniper school, went to RSLIC, ended up doing a few other like JFO things and JTAC stuff and training with the Air Force out there. Training with the ODAs because 10th Group is based out of there. Yep. So
we often, I even had my sniper team teach your snipes, I'm assuming 4th ID snipes, all the time. Anytime we did something where we had helicopters or whatever, we'd get with 4th ID, get all the snipes from the scouts and do stuff. It was cool, man.
We ended up doing that cold weather course with you guys up there in the mountains and Pikes Peak, and that was that was cold.
Yeah.
But it was good, you know, working on how to pack horses and stuff like that. And so great skills learned there. Then after that, I ended up getting out after a tour to Afghanistan. I was battalion sniper section leader, E6. I had a pretty good tour. It was fun, but working up in the Kunar, it's a whole different ballgame compared to Iraq. So now you're navigating, you know, mountains and elevation. There's only one road in and out, which I preferred because less IEDs.
Yeah.
So we were just, you know, doing nothing but air assaults and stuff. Good tour there. And then I got out. No one in San Diego is really trying to hire a sniper. And so there was a whole lot of trying to figure out what the hell I was going to do with my life next. So I ended up doing personal protection work for various celebrities and CEOs and CFOs out of LA and San Diego, babysitting billionaires.
Yeah.
So it was probably the greatest job I ever had, but the worst company I ever worked for.
Really?
Just in the essence of, you know, everything's always different. Everything's always fast paced. You're advancing locations. You're rubbing shoulders with, you know, Hollywood elite and kind of really getting a view in the back door of what that world looks like. And it's not a world that I would ever want to live in. I'll promise you that.
Yeah.
So got done with that. And then I ended up trying to figure out what the hell I was going to do as a bartender. And then I was a kayak tour guide in La Jolla. And none of that's really paying the bills in San Diego. So I ended up contracting for State Department. Went over with Triple Canopy as a DDM on the U.S. Ambassadors team. And then we did a lot of low pro stuff. Did that for a couple of years.
And DDM is basically our sniper, right?
Like, yeah, because the State Department doesn't want to call them snipers because it's too aggressive. Yeah.
Designated
defensive marksman.
Defensive marksman, yeah.
Yeah, did that for a couple of years and got back. And then my mentor kind of threw me a bone, Jonathan Wegner. So he's a co-founder of LifeProof Phone Cases.
Nice.
And went over to Otterbox. And so now he's actually working for SOG Knives and really completely revamped that brand, which was needed. Because
really cool.
At that point, you know, SOG was a knife that you would buy in a gas station, and now they're, you know, they definitely made a turnaround. So he threw me a bone and brought me on as a social media manager for this company based out of San Diego, and really started understanding marketing and ad development. And then I had to create all my own content, so I really picked a camera back up again, and just kind of grew from there. And then I started working for other companies, and I worked for one guy from the veteran community, whom I won't speak his name, but he was an absolutely terrible CEO that ended up burning a lot of bridges within the community, and essentially at this point is PNG'd. But that was a lot of growth that I got through that. And now, currently, I'm full-time marketing creative director, photography. I'm working for Oakley full-time, working for SOG Knives full-time, and then there's a clothing company based in San Diego, kind of like a SEAL brand, but it's called ERT Clothing.
Yeah.
So working for those guys, and it's sick, dude. I don't have an office. I'm traveling, you know, around the country. I think I was on the road like 215 days last year, just pissing off. It was fun. And it's kind of where I land now.
So as a full-time guy for these businesses, you're like their creative, I'm assuming. You're like shooting video or
video, photo,
yeah,
ad concepts and producing ads.
Have you found like that's, I mean, because you told me that you wanted to be a photographer in the military. Did you kind of find your niche in that as a creative outlet? You're like, this is where I need to be.
It kind of started out of desperation. So when I was working for that first company, it was a 3D printing manufacturer. And right, so there's nothing sexy about that.
Yeah.
And the content, or what we call in the marketing world, UGC, user generated content, was just disgusting. You know, you got a bunch of nerds that are, you know, making World of Warcraft toys and stuff on the 3D printer. Mm-hmm. So I had to kind of pick up a camera again and start taking photos and good content that was actually going to be, you know, tangible and worthy of our social media accounts. And then I just kept the camera and then just started taking a bunch of photos and really grew it from there. And Oakley at the time, through Oakley SI, they lost pretty much like the main guy. His name's Drew Wallace. He was in Ranger Battalion. He left the company, and so they didn't have anybody that was in the military in order to help produce the ads or make sure the uniforms are cohesive and all the gear is appropriate and stuff like that. And so they brought me on to kind of help them with that ad production, content creation, and stuff like that.
Really cool. I think I've always had a lot of respect for Oakley. Obviously, wearing Oakleys and issued Oakleys my entire military career, but the brand itself, like they, I've always identified that brand as being a legitimate brand. It was squared away when it came to representing military or whatever it was. And it's kind of cool that they think about that when picking guys up like you,
yeah,
with your background. Are you still like, have you fully transitioned now? I mean, do you feel like you're at a point now where you're figuring shit out? Or are you still trying to navigate that?
No, I feel really confident in my career path and where I stand. I was kind of stoked to put down a gun and pick up a camera for a living. Which has actually kind of changed as of recently. I got another security detail that kind of fell in my lap that I didn't really want to turn down.
Yeah.
And so pick that back up. And I guess it's always something that like I can't get away from it.
But opportunity to travel too, but right, also use your camera as well. I mean,
yeah, exactly. Cool. So now I just got to try to figure out how to be security as well as take a photo. And
yeah, but
a lot of it's also kind of blending in too. So if you're looking like a tourist with a camera, then you're not looking like security. So it also works in your benefit.
Yeah, absolutely.
I want to stay like with this. There's a few companies that I would love to work for, as far as like creative outlets, like Arc'teryx,
yeah,
or you know, maybe Patagonia or something like that.
Do you find? I mean, a lot of people don't understand that. Like when you say something like I want to pick up a camera instead of a gun, and you had mentioned about the being a sniper. Nobody wants to hire a sniper. I mean, I've experienced that in my own life story, where, you know, I got my degree, I got everything that you need to fill these specific jobs, and I can't get the job because I'm a sniper. I mean, it literally says that all over my resume, and not realizing that the civilian population looks at that as like a liability.
Very much so. I mean, dude, when I got out, I applied to over 160 jobs. My resume and cover letter was looked at from numerous CEOs. And so, you know, I know it wasn't shit, you know, it wasn't written in crayon. But up until that, like 160 positions, and I didn't get a single call back. And I was trying to be a valet driver, I was trying to be a bartender, but they do look at that as a liability, regardless of your skill sets. You know, anybody can be a bar back, and I still wasn't even somehow qualified for that. So it was really demoralizing, trying to, and you know, coming back and just really feeling unwanted. You know, I knew that I had all these skill sets that I wanted to take to a company or a restaurant, whether it be leadership abilities or being timely. You know, I had to be, you know, at a place at a certain time every day for 8 years that I was in. And like, you would think like that would be something that, absolutely, you know, a company would value, but no one wanted it. And so when I was throwing that bone to end up doing the social media thing, that was like my foot in the door, and I just had to run with it. And I had to make sure that everything I had produced was, you know, to the best of my abilities.
Let's talk about your first combat deployment with working with the SEALs in Iraq. I was there. What, you were there 05?
06, 07, entirely pretty, yeah, much.
So I was there. I did a trip there 06 and 07. We were on the same rotation cycle as the SEALs. And but I was in Baghdad in 06 and Baghdad in 07. I was at MSS Fernandez in 07. But those years in 06 and 07 were the worst. I mean, I think they're the best years, but they're the worst years for most casualties on the battlefield. I think 07 was. And then also operational tempo. We were doing more operations. I mean, some nights we did 3 hits in a night. It was super active from Ramadi to Baghdad and everywhere in between. I mean, it was busy. What was that experience like for you, kind of reflecting on it now from kind of the platform and the position that you're in now? What's that look like now?
It was an eye opener. You know, 18, you're told in basic, you know, you're told in the train up, like, get ready for war and blah, blah, blah. But like, you really don't actually, like, you can't prepare for that.
Yeah.
And my unit specifically, 126, we had, the rest of our battalion was up in Adamiya, up in Baghdad. And we were the hardest hit battalion since Vietnam. Wow. I think we lost 37 guys that tour, numerous IEDs. Crispy Avila is, yep, he was in my unit, wow, and in that Charlie company. And they actually like staged like, you know, a mutiny against the command, because every time that they're going outside the wire, there was a deep pressure EMP that was literally flipping our Bradleys upside down and, you know, just turning them into molten metal.
And the command was just like, accepted risk, keep going.
Yeah,
keep
accepted risk. But there was no even like mission. It was presence patrols. Wow. It was driving down the streets. And yeah, so if there's no mission, then like, what are we doing?
What's the task and purpose?
Right. Yeah. Like, we're fine doing a mission, but if there's no mission and we're still getting killed left and right, then what's the point in this?
Yeah.
And that was up in Baghdad. And down in Ramadi, it was super, super kinetic. You could not walk outside the wire to do a day patrol at all. And guaranteed within the first 5 minutes, you're going to come under contact.
Wow.
And it was heavy contact in the middle of the city. So a lot of our role was infilling the SEALs, providing backup support. Our snipers would work with them kind of hand in hand, securing buildings and making sure that there wasn't going to be any, no one sneaking out through the doors and stuff. And so infilling those guys, and they would get into some pretty serious ticks. Some of them got very injured via hand grenades that were thrown up on top of a roof and almost overpowered. Yeah. So then we would just come in with a 25 and just start hosing, send out dismounts, and really just try to secure the area and make sure that we could get those guys out of there. So we had to do a bunch of medevacs for those guys. But the level of just kind of like travesties that we would see, we ended up kicking in this hospital door, and it was a multi-story building in the middle of downtown Ramadi. We would go in there, and there was bodies in formaldehyde that they were kind of studying, like laying in coolers and stuff.
Wow.
Women, infants, kids that they were testing, whether it be chemical weapons or, you know, even small arm stuff, trying out different amputations and stuff. Maybe they were trying to work on their own, you know, medical, because they're not skilled in that, and trying to keep guys on the battlefield. But after 15 months, man, we were just really getting beat down. Yeah. So towards the end of it, after losing so many guys, we got to a point where we ended up doing call outs through the whole city. And we were working with the Marines and the SEALs to where it's like hands across, and we're just going to do a massive sweep through the city over the course of 3 days and four nights. And did that. And I mean, collectively, we probably racked up well over 250, 300 enemy KIA. We lost a few guys during that. But after that, like, we really kind of like quelled the city, and it was quiet for a long time, up until, you know, ISIS and stuff like that ended up taking over and took repossession of the city.
That's nuts, man. That's a, like, when you think, I mean, I was on the task force side, and we were doing, offensive hits, just targeting HUTs every night, both 6, 7, and 8. But that strategy of, you know, Jocko's a highly respected commander for many reasons. But a lot of it has to do with the strategy that he implemented and the leadership he implemented and targeting deliberately with a plan, the bad guys in Ramadi, and tying it into a broader strategy, which included probably civil affairs and psychological operations and all kinds of, you know, intelligence requirements. That trip for you, do you still think about that trip?
I guess especially now more recently than not. Just because in the past, I'd probably say 3 years, I've had to bury a lot of friends due to suicide.
A lot of those from that unit, from 126.
Yeah, from that unit, and then from, you know, specifically from that tour.
Yeah.
And that's been pretty rough trying to figure out, you know, like what kind of demons these guys are dealing with from that tour. I don't know how the hell I got so fortunate to not really suffer, you know, many of those issues. I'm not having nightmares or, night terrors or anything like that. And I've found other cathartic means to kind of deal with that stress through surfing and, you know, being outdoors and snowboarding and just really kind of keeping my mind off of that. But, you know, when I get the phone calls that so-and-so isn't with us anymore, there's a few days of reflection there.
Yeah, that's tough. That's the hardest thing is, like, especially dudes that who they self-select. They isolate themselves because they don't want to be a burden on anybody.
Right.
And they fucking check out. And that bumps me out the most because I'm like, dude, those dudes, if I would have known or anybody would have known that they were living with those kind of demons, you would have been there.
Yeah,
it's like, how
sure.
can you be there for a guy who's basically offensively, deliberately checking out? Like, he's doing things on purpose to get to himself to a point. I've had many friends check out in SF. And I hear it all the time from infantry guys because, I mean, the fortunate thing about you is you have creative outlets. You have all these things. You have a life outside of the military. But a lot of guys in the military, that was their life. And then when they get out, they don't have support networks. They don't have skill sets. Or they don't have a passion for a lot of things.
And they're not allowed to discover what that passion is.
Yeah.
And I think geographically I'm fortunate as well because I live in San Diego, right? So I always have a plethora of things to do. Whereas if you're in like small town Ohio, where
COVID,
locked
the fuck
COVID,
down.
I mean, there's only two main industries in the town. It might be mining, it might be farming or something like that. Like, you know, there's nobody there that's going to nurture them to find, you know, creative outlets, or there's nothing to do. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, you kind of get in a rut, you get in your head, you feel unwanted, you know, your glory days are behind you. And, mm-hmm. and now what the hell are you going to do?
Yeah, it's weird. I think, you know, when I see guys like you who go in the infantry so young, I mean, at 18, I was in the infantry when I was 17. Like, I mean, 18-year-olds in America are like chill, like they're infants. Like, right. they're just so underdeveloped and experienced in many senses. And then when you accelerate that curve by going to war, it's insane because you grew up really fast. Assuming when you came back from that first rotation, you're a changed human being.
I was never the same.
Yeah.
Never the same. I mean, you realize how finite life is. I have a journal that I actually kept there when I was doing guard rotations. I found it the other day. It was, you know, cliche green notebook, and I was reading it and just rereading. So I'm 33 now, rereading my words when I was 18 and my thoughts. And, you know, we had a guy that detonated a suicide vest and, you know, blew him to pieces, and no one got hurt, but I was sitting there up on guard, and also no one came and picked him up. So then sitting there watching the dogs and the cats, you know, eat them and stuff like that at the age of 18, like looking at it now, I'm like, holy shit, dude. Like,
wow.
Yeah, this is a game changer. And it takes you from 0 to 100 real quick as far as maturity.
Yeah.
And yeah, I look back at it, or like I look at 18-year-olds now and I'm like, damn.
Yeah.
Like,
I see 20-something-year-olds, yeah. And I'm like, man.
The level of naivety is just
crazy, man.
And then to get thrown full force into probably the most kinetic years of that war is it was changing. So, you know, looking at it from that perspective, maybe it does make sense that these guys, you know, that are having suicidal thoughts, or the ones that are actually committing suicide, you know, the level of fragility with your mind at that time, it has lasting effects, and sometimes ones that you can't shake.
Yeah. What, do you have a process for any of the things that you deal with? Like if something surfaces, do you have like, hey, I'm deliberately doing X, Y, Z? Is there a process there?
Long runs, man. Yeah. Long runs. Like my biggest cathartic means of kind of handling shitty thoughts and stuff is just punishing myself on runs. I've always been a runner. And so like my MO now is, you know, if I'm really like in my head, I run until like I want to stop, but then I have to go all the way back. And so awesome. Then I just punish myself even more. And
yeah.
Usually I'm actually like sometimes stoked, like when I end up throwing up.
Yeah.
I'm like, hell yeah. Like I got it out. Let's do this.
Is that like in the military, that pushing of ourselves, which is often, I mean, it's probably correlated with a feeling of being alive, right? We're constantly feeling like we're alive because we're pushing the limits and feeling physical pain and addressing. I mean, everything's very overt, even communication with your peers. It's like there's nothing hidden or masked.
Right.
But then you get into civilian life and you kind of live, you kind of insulate and suppress yourself from everything. And you can't have conversations. You can't have open and honest conversations. You can't get out there and abuse yourself. And is there some kind of, what is the thing there that makes that satisfying or helps you deal with stuff?
And it is definitely because it like makes you feel alive. I also am like, I love competing against myself, mm-hmm. and more or less like my brain.
Yeah.
You know, so like my mind is telling me like, dude, I'm tired. Like, let's stop. I just literally just talk shit to myself. I'm like, nope, let's go. You know, and I did it through recce selection. I did it through RSLIC. I did it through sniper school. Anytime that it sucked, and granted, sniper school is not that difficult, but anytime that it sucked, like I thrived in that. Like I loved it because I felt like I was like not only proving something to me, but also like proving it to all my peers and everyone around me. Like you can't get me. Like I got this. And I think that is a huge level of it. And I also understand like I'm fortunate to be able to run down the beach. I'm fortunate to be able to go surf, you know, and the guys that we lost down there, they can't do that.
Yeah.
So like do it for them,
yeah.
You know, like put yourself for them, like be the best person that you can be because that's what they would want.
Yeah. I have the same mindset. I mean, when I hear peers kind of going down that road and just kind of that kind of drama, I'm always quick to point out, like if that person was alive and they saw you acting like that, they would just beat that ass because that we have no time for that. Like we have an opportunity. opportunity to live and love and do all the things they can't do. And it's almost a, it's not almost, it's a responsibility of us or for us to live that life they couldn't, you know, and I think that's important.
And I never understood like their thought process, right? So for the longest time, because I was ingrained with, you're the greatest, you're as strong as you can be, you know, with military indoctrination, I thought of suicide as just kind of like a weak way out, right? I saw it as selfish, and like as sad as I was, it also made me angry at the same time, because I'd never felt that, you know, I've never felt like that, and so I couldn't understand it. And so a little over a year ago, I got divorced after 10 years, and it came as like a sudden shock. And at the very same day that happened, was the very same day that I got called and got laid off. And I was living down in Mexico at the time. And so now I'm left, like my life as I knew it completely changed. And I went down like a pretty dark hole of depression. I went to the VA and just like bawled my eyes out to the psych there and just kind of explained everything to him. And I was like, I just want to feel better. And so they put me on antidepressants, which I took for all 5 days, and showed every single side effect. You know, I was sweating profusely for no reason. I was shaking uncontrollably. I couldn't even type. No sleep, no sex drive. I went from 210 pounds to 170 and just stayed in my room.
Wow.
And or stayed in my house. And it was at that time, through like that level of depression, where I thought about the guys that, you know, had killed themselves. And I actually understood it.
Yeah.
Like I could understand that, like if my level of depression got worse and went down like a rut, because nothing was fun, you know, like nothing excited me. There was nothing to look forward to. It was just, how long can I sleep? You know, so that way I don't have to like think about shit. But once I understood that and like I kind of dealt with my little bout of depression, really gave me a whole different perspective on these guys that are killing themselves. And it gave me a new level of respect for what they're going through. And if they feel like that's the best way, then like they're in a dark hole.
Yeah. A lot of people don't understand that. We always associate depression with like a mental state, but it's very physical in so many ways. I mean, one, it's chemically, it's physical. And when you're like, I've experienced the same thing, a fit of depression where I was like, so this is depression. Like it was a different world.
Yep.
Like all the things that you think you could balance with a healthy mind, you don't have that capability. You're underwater. You're not struggling to stay above water. You're already underwater.
Right.
And so the navigation of that world was intense, man. I remember, I think some impactful advice that I got, cause I was desperate for anything. Cause I was very confused because I'd never been there. Hard charger, strong mindset, often made fun of people that were like what's his problem, like what the, you know, who'd ever get depressed, like this is awesome. And then I'm like, how the fuck did I get here? And it related to my divorce as well, which is I think a compounding life change, but also fits into so many emotions that just takes you over the edge. And I remember thinking to myself like, man, what is a way out of this? And maybe it was a podcast or something like that, a book, and it had talked about how we're so in our head, immersed in our head, which I felt like I was lost in my own head, and we have to find an outlet to get out. And that's when I found yoga, one, physically making me do something because I didn't want to do anything.
Yeah.
I wanted to stay inside. I wanted to insulate. And then two, the physical exertion that I got, which was probably releasing endorphins, positive chemical reactions. And then also the social aspect of communicating to people again. I forced myself in that, and I slowly, almost day by day or class by class, came out of that. But dude, that was scary, man, because I had thoughts of like, I have no other options here, right? Which is what these guys are feeling. They're desperate for change, and they don't want to be a burden. And the only option they have is checking out. And I do sympathize with that, not encouraging that, but sympathizing with it, because it's a scary fucking thing, man.
Yeah. I was super fortunate. My best friend, and he was our sniper in Ramadi. He ended up calling me out of the blue and like FaceTiming even, and I typically like wouldn't answer, especially FaceTime. I fucking hate FaceTiming.
Yeah.
But he called me and I answered it in 2 hour, just gnarly conversation.
Yeah. And he knew you were fucked up, or he had
a
sense.
Yeah, but I don't know how. He had a sense somehow. And I don't know how, but like I thank him every day for it. Mm-hmm. And I had a 2 hour conversation. And as soon as we got done with that conversation, it was the first time I ate in a week.
Wow.
Like it was the first time I felt like I could actually put something in my body now.
Wow.
And started eating, started talking to him like every day. And then I had a good buddy of mine. He's in the teams currently, actually. He drove down from San Diego and just like showed up at my house and stayed with me for like 3 days. And we were just shooting the shit and really just good conversations.
Yeah.
And it's like that, you know, it's the cliche battle buddy thing.
Yeah.
And I wasn't reaching out for help, but they found it and they gave it to me. And so, you know, after 5 days, I threw the antidepressants down the toilet and then just started finding other means. And I was still just like self-medicating, you know, I was doing drugs and drinking and really kind of had like this like Hunter S. Thompson moment where I was up on my roof in Mexico and smoking a cigarette. And I don't even smoke, and drinking a bottle of tequila. And I just kind of had like this epiphany where I was like, all right, dude, this is your last night. And after that, I really started getting hungry, looking for work. And I moved back to San Diego, and then everything has just kind of blown up for me exponentially, like in nothing but positive and good ways. Great friends, great social structure. I live in a great place. I'm in a good head state, great career. And so it just, sometimes you just got to hit rock bottom in order to kind of really, really see what that's like and then find success after.
That's awesome, man. Yeah. And for people listening to this, if you're in that state, or you're not in that state and you have friends that are in that state, just reach out to those guys. I actually just did it recently. I had a buddy who was, he was actually one of my team guys, and I hadn't heard from him in a while, and he got shot in the head, survived that, like a PKM round to the head, had an RPG blow. He had like 3 purple hearts in 1 rotation, bad rotation. Good for him, because he's that kind of guy. He wants to be involved, but I just kind of reached out to him because I had a feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how he gauged these things, but if you have those guys in your network and you ain't heard from them in a while, you might want to reach out, man, because we're all in this kind of like boat together.
Yeah.
And no matter how you swing it, especially from that era, man. I deployed every year since 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, and then 13, and then GRS 14, 15, 16.
Mm-hmm.
So that error of 5, 6, 7, 8 is such a huge error for war.
Yeah.
That a lot of people who haven't experienced that, or who have experienced that, understand what that is, because that was as close as we get to our, you know, the best generation,
right,
of fighting a real war. And often I see like guys no doubt fought war in Afghanistan and Iraq at different periods of time, but it was just so constant. And I lost a guy in my company, which is a small special forces company, every year in some form or fashion through every rotation that we did, because of the how volatile that mm-hmm. era was. Well, I'm glad you made it. And I'm glad you're here, man. You're doing a lot of creative stuff. And I'm assuming a lot of this is about your passions, like things that you enjoy and love to do. I'm a closet photographer. Like I grew up in that world. Grew up in reconnaissance like you.
Yeah.
Voyeurist, that nature, trained observer by trade, but also love it. You know, what is it about photography that kind of drives you to be who you are?
I mean, I started taking photos when I was 12 and sucked. I was taking photos in Ramadi actually during that tour. I was a SAW gunner, but I had a Nikon on my back. And I was taking just random shots, and we had this journalist that was embedded with us from Esquire, and his photographer that he came out with ended up getting food poisoning and canceled the trip. So I'm up in guard one day, and he comes up to our guard tower, and he's like, "Hey, I hear you take photos." And I was like, "Yeah, dude, I'll show you." And I was all excited to show him. And so I showed him, and he's like, "Do you mind if I get some of these on a thumb drive?" And I was like, "No problem." And I wasn't thinking about copyright or anything like that, dude. I was 18.
You
I was
jacked
like,
your shit,
I was
man.
Like, "Here you go." So I gave them to him, but the next thing I know, like a check from Esquire shows up. and they bought the photos off me for a good price.
Really?
And so it really kind of...
Did they publish them?
Yeah, it was in Esquire UK, but I still never even seen the magazine.
Wow.
I was trying to look it up, but, you know, trying to find like a UK publication was pretty tough.
That's so cool though.
Yeah, and it really, it gave me feeling of like, maybe I can actually do this, you know, like maybe I'm not just, you know, the random kid with a camera that takes shit photos.
Yeah.
But now I would say it's just about telling like the story and evoking the emotion of what I see and like what I feel at the time. I just want people to see the world like through my eyes. Mm-hmm. And being able to tell any story possible. I've written for Black Rifle Coffee on a few occasions, mm-hmm. and various other publications, but I actually hate writing, but I'm somewhat decent at it. And so I think with my photos and words kind of combined, I really like to give people some insight.
I love that, man. I love it. I mean, I'm fascinated by it because I wonder, there's when you identify a guy who's like a creative, I'm allergic to this creative conversation. when you find a guy who's a creative, I'm fascinated with creatives. I myself grew up in art, and I always wonder what that thing is that drives people to be creative. Because when guys don't have outlets, like your art, like you said, you surf, like that's an art in a various form. Like mm-hmm. it's something that's very impactful, but it is a outlet for creativity in a lot of ways. You're doing it for a living now. Are you afraid that it's going to degrade, like when you're getting paid to do it and it becomes your job, do you feel like it's going to degrade your ability to have a love for it, a passion for it?
It has been. I've gotten down to myself on numerous occasions because the large majority of people will look at a photo and be like, all right, that's cool, and like move on. Whereas like, to me, that photo means a lot more, you know, like I want you to look at it. Like, I want you to just like think about it. And it's like people walking through art galleries and just really kind of questioning like what the artist was thinking. And so I realized that, you know, my work isn't valued like I value it. So that was also my push into video and really started doing video because that is what is very engaging to people and being able to tell that story from beginning, middle and finish. With appropriate music and appropriate cuts and stuff like that. So my push into video has really kind of breathed fresh air into my creative outlets. Now I look at everything kind of like through a camera and then I'm like, all right, like that's the shot that I want. And I find examples of what right looks like. You know, there is a scene in a movie that really like emotionally impacts me. Then I think of, okay, how can I recreate that with my videos? And there's some stuff that I do, you know, freelance shit where people have asked me to film a yoga session for 3 hours and I'm like, what am I doing? But then there's other times where, good friend of mine, Justin Melnick, he's on the SEAL Team show on CBS and they have a bunch of other team guys that really consult on that show. And he has a good network there. He has me doing photo shoots with him all the time for various companies. That provide him gear for...
Is he the dog handler?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, for Hollywood and stuff. Yeah. And so he has me hanging off of World War II decommissioned ships in LA, like shooting, active duty dudes, fast roping off of, you know, or doing VBSS stuff, run Zodiacs. They're using all kinds of Gucci gear, being submerged. And so shooting stuff like that is like, I'm stoked on it. And then when other people in the industry see it, like, you know, I mean... It's all Gucci, right? You know, people from the outside perspective look at our former jobs or our jobs and the gear and really, you know, just get a hard on by it. And so being able to shoot that kind of stuff with hundreds of thousands of dollars in gear and just, you know, like I said, World War II ships or hanging out at Blackhawks and doing Spies and Fries stuff really stokes me out. And I'm super fortunate to be able to do that.
Are you ever going to go back? Do you ever think you'll go back to the beginning? Do you think you'll go back to a life of, you know, carrying a gun? Is that something that kind of interests you? Did you get all the things that you wanted to get out of that experience, or is there something else missing?
There was in the military. I feel like I got out slightly prematurely. A lot of that had to do with my ex-wife and me trying to save the marriage. And I was kind of pigeonholed at that point in time because I wasted, and not to say wasted, but, you know, half of my career was over in Europe with no schools and gaining rank. So by the time I realized like what right looked like, you know, and granted I wasn't soft, but having a taste of the small teams, like the hand selection process in recce, I was like, this is it. And like, I was top, like peak my game, you know, physically, mentally, I was on my shit. And so I wanted to go either to Ranger Battalion or you know, go to SFAS and go down that world. But my ex was like, I can't do this anymore. And as an E6 without a tab, you can't, you know, you're not walking into that. So I just decided to kind of opt out. But I mean, ultimately, I think my military goal would have been to like go to RRC or something like that. I think that would have been...
That's still something I always think about. I'm like, man, RRC would have been badass.
Yeah, it would have been sick. But as far as now, I mean, outside of that one security gig that I have coming up here shortly, I didn't think that I was ever going to do it again. I thought that was kind of behind me. One of the most euphoric, I guess, memories that I have post-separation is when I was able to essentially remove military from my resume was a good day for me because I realized now I don't have to divulge to these HR managers anymore that I was in the military. And so their preconceived notions and stuff like that isn't going to affect my employment. However, I still have my tactical resume. If ever that comes up, I've been asked to join personal details for now the richest man in the world, that I turned down just because of that op tempo. You're on the road all the time. You're not able to have a home life. So it wasn't really something that I wanted to do. However, I was super fortunate. So me and a good friend of mine, Jake Wiest, we have a 1,000-acre ranch out east of San Diego. So it's literally an hour east off the freeway. And that ranch has been in his family since 1912.
Wow.
We got a 55-acre lake, two cabins, multiple different kinds of terrain and stuff like that. And so being in San Diego and being a long gunner by trade, I didn't really have anywhere to shoot. So Jake invited me out years ago, and I was able to shoot out to 2,600 meters,
wow,
which is unheard of.
Yeah.
So with that, you know, I have a lot of friends that are, you know, active duty in the teams on the West Coast. And so we invited them out there, and we were doing various photo shoots and stuff for H&K and SIG and other companies. And the team guys were like, dude, this is only an hour east. We don't have to fly to Idaho. We don't have to fly to Arizona. So now we have a lot of guys coming out there and doing training with us.
Really cool.
We've dumped a bunch of money into it as far as building up structures. So we're going to have kind of like a bay with weapons cleaning, you know, bunks, TV, bar, you know, that
really
whole
good.
We got all kinds of toys and stocking up on the night vision and, you know, the guns. We bermed everything up to make it super safe. And so now we're having NSW coming out there and they're training their sniper cell. And
it's awesome.
I'll be running courses on my own to civilians. I haven't decided fully like if I actually like want to dive into this. But the option's there. And I always have people ask me to help teach them how to shoot, and whether it be pistol or movement to contact or long guns and stuff like that. So now we just kind of rent out the space, rent it out to Oakley for photo shoots and stuff. So that way they don't need licensing and permits through, you know, California.
Yeah.
But yeah, we keep it private, and it's very, you know, very select with who we have on that property, but it's nice.
I love that, man. I think many people, I mean, there's a misconception about snipers in the military. Like, a lot of guys can go to sniper school. I mean, I could have went to Big Army sniper school as a reenlistment option at one point. But being an actual sniper as your identifier, as your job, is completely different. In fact, in the military, in the infantry, it's rare. It's also rare in special operations. I mean, Kevin Owens used to run our schoolhouse. We were snipers together. But unless you're a SIF or CAG sniper or Ranger sniper, then you probably are just qualified. So there's a whole community of snipers. Not to say if you go to school, you got the training. But what I mean is, there's something about a sniper that's very unique, and their understanding kind of the world around them. I don't know what it is. It's hard to put your finger on, but I love that because it's like, once you're a sniper, you always have that, and it's like when you even pick up a long gun, it's like that love for that, or the love for like the positioning or the breaking the shot or calling wins or following Trace. All those things are very romantic, and they're very passionate when it comes to the men and their connection with the long gun. It's a beautiful thing, man.
Yeah, there really is. I mean, I'd rather shoot a long gun over, you know, any AR platform, even like running and gunning or pistol or transitions or anything like that. Like, too. That stuff's sexy, but there's just something about, I guess, trying to tackle Mother Earth and the winds and also tackling, you know, the ballistics and the gun and your own body and trigger pull and stuff like that. It's an art in and of itself. And there's nothing more rewarding than doing the math, really getting figured out, and then having a first round hit.
When that's honed, when that's all like brought in together, it's such a magical thing, man. It's beautiful, man.
Yeah.
God, I don't know. I can geek out on sniper stuff. What outlets do you have now for guys that can get in contact with you for like this idea about, I'm assuming that people who listen to this are thinking maybe creative like me, like they're like, oh man, I could train, I could do creative stuff, I could do, I could follow in and tune into what Nick has going on. Are you doing a lot of social? Are you out there right now?
Yeah, I'm definitely on social media. I've been working a lot with this organization ran by a former Dev Crew guy called One More Wave. Mm. And so what he does is he kind of empowers veterans that are disabled or, you know, I mean, it doesn't have to be a physical ailment, you know, it could be mental. And they will build you custom surfboards.
Really cool.
Or a custom surfboard and take you out in the water and really teach you, you know, how to ride a wave. And
wow.
And that means of you know, like a cathartic process to deal with anything. I mean, there's just nothing more therapeutic to me than the ocean.
Yeah.
And so working with those guys is huge. There's another organization called Dead Reckoning Collective. And what they've really done is kind of given veterans like a voice through creative means. So Leo Jenkins is a very accomplished writer.
Yeah, Leo
Jenkins. Marty Scolvin, all those guys are affiliated with Dead Reckoning, and they're publishing books for guys, you know, MARSOC guys that are now writing poems and photographers and painters. And this seems almost like a taboo kind of road to go down for guys like us. But it's not, you know, like it's not for the hipsters, you know, it's for everybody. And if you find, you know, any joy in creating something, then I highly encourage people to do it. And especially with all this COVID shit going on, like, don't sit in your house. Like, don't just snack down on a bottle of booze and play video games. The thing that I've done during COVID the most is I go on YouTube University. I'm enrolled at LA Film School right now in my last year, so I'm about to get my degree in graphic design. But going on YouTube and just watching either instructional videos or inspiration, like, you don't know if you're gonna like it or not. And so I encourage guys to write, take photos, like paint some shit, you know, find something. And if you don't like it, then it's fine, then find something else. But don't pigeonhole ourselves thinking like, you know, gun is, you know, like, you know, going to the firing range is the only way of therapy.
Mm-hmm.
So be creative and figure out whatever that is. And if it's woodworking or metallurgy, like, make a knife, you know, and it's all about the network too that you build. Reach out to a local knife maker and just maybe apprentice under him. Learn a new trade, learn a new craft, and learn a new skill.
That's what I love about the creative is nobody could take that away from you. You know, it's like, it's kind of a vocational skill set. It's a very technical skill set that, you know, that you could invaluably apply to your life and make it whatever you want it to be. I mean, that's a gain of independence that a lot of people don't understand. Like, once you understand that you can monetize and make a living off of your creativity, nobody owns you. I mean,
right.
You do whatever you want to do.
Right. And, you know, at this point I've kind of become my own boss. I can yay and nay, you know, whatever it may be. As far as jobs go, if I don't want to do it, then I don't have to do it. Now, I understand that I'm fortunate that way, and some people don't really have the option to kind of pick and choose their work, but you can get there with enough work or with enough, you know, wherewithal and just kind of pushing it. Something that I really kind of figured out is during COVID and the pandemic, photographers are out of work, graphic designers are out of work, social media managers are out of work. Well, if I know how to do all of those, then I'm the most highly, you know, desired person for their marketing team, because now I can fulfill the roles of three different people and they're still paying me. So
awesome.
I've actually, you know, kind of thrived during that process just because I wanted to be indispensable.
Yeah.
And it was the same process in the military. I wanted to be the go-to guy. I wanted to be the guy with the answers. And I still want to be that, but now it's just in a creative field.
What's your social media handles or any handles that you have that people can hit you up at?
Yeah, my personal Instagram is N_Betts, B-E-T-T-S. My photography Instagram is linked there in the bio as well as my website. I am very careful about what I post and just to make it very visually appealing. You're not going to see my cheeseburger in my feed. So, but
this is your resume online, though.
Yeah, essentially it is. You know, it's my portfolio, and I'm super active on it. And I have people reaching out to me all the time, asking questions about creative or asking questions about transition from the military. I've helped out a lot of guys that I served with on their way out because it's a terrifying process getting out. And you're jumping into the unknown, you're leaving that safety blanket of the biweekly paycheck and the free healthcare and the living. So like, I get it, I really get it, and I've been there. So people reaching out to me on social media, I'm very quick to answer them and respond just to try to help anybody that I can, because if I can save anybody the heartache that I had to go through trying to find my way, like once I got out, then I definitely want to bestow that upon other people.
Awesome, man. Nick, thanks for stopping by the studio, man, and sharing your story and you know, being open and honest about the stuff we talked about. It's good to have you finally here, man.
Yeah, dude, it's finally good to see you in person, and it's been a long time coming, and thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks, man.